So tell me about the marketing of Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Well, this is kind of weird. This is something that's been cropping up, and it's starting to, you know, kind of gnaw at the back of my mind. What they've been doing is they've got everybody tweeting and hitting each other up on Facebook saying, hey, would you like to see the new Scott Pilgrim trailer? If we can get 100,000 fans on our Scott Pilgrim Facebook page, then they're going to release the trailer.
And what do you think about that?
I think they're going to release the trailer one way or the other. And I think it's kind of it's weird because everybody's trying to capture on the whole viral marketing thing, and I appreciate that. And I love Edgar. I'm really excited about the film now. I'm really looking forward to it. And I know they're going to release a trailer, but especially at the height of when people are complaining about these various groups, marketing setups to where when you join certain groups, your Facebook information is shared with those people. Essentially, what the company is doing is collecting all this marketing information on the audience by saying, hey, if you click this, the faster you can get your friends to click this, the faster we'll release the trailer. And what they're doing is collecting marketing information on everybody when they were going to show us the trailer anyway. And I just think it's kind of a weird divergent thing from what we saw with Paranormal Activity, where it's like, hey, if you want it in your town, get a certain number of people to tell us you want it in your town, and then we'll know that we can open it in a theater. That made sense. This is just a little weird. And
what I heard about that was that, theaters have to book like weeks in advance. So they already kind of knew which theaters they would book in.
People didn't know that in advance. So they didn't realize that their cities had already been picked, but it got, at least it seemed like it made sense. You know, it conceptually, oh, I'm going to get a bunch of people from my town to say, hey, let's do this as a marketing campaign.
Right. Whereas there's no reason to have people freaking like, you know, the trailer, releasing a trailer is good for you. There's no reason you need to have people sign up to get a trailer out.
Edgar's not sitting there going, man, nobody's interested in this movie. 95,000 people, I don't know. But if you get 100,000 people, 100,000 people, yeah, you know what? Then I will release this trailer. No, they've already got the trailer. They're already ready to release it. They're just trying to get everybody to give them free advertising through Twitter and Facebook. And I think it's the first time we've really seen it where it's kind of gratuitous.
But let me ask you this, Cargill. How well do you think this movie is going to do? Scott Pilgrim versus the World. If you could, and I'm not going to hold you to this. This is not, does not reflect on your journalistic whatever. And I know a lot's going to happen I know a lot's going to happen between now and August, you know, in terms of marketing and advertising and whatever. If you could predict what the opening weekend gross of Scott Pilgrim is, what would you say?
You know, to be perfectly honest, I'm terrible with weekend grosses. So I really can't. I want to say in that period of time, unless something weird happens, I'm thinking we're looking at somewhere between like 15, 17, and possibly 30 million opening weekend.
All right. Well, okay.
It's in mid to late August. It seems to have the same kind of buzz and excitement as a Kick-Ass
does. I was going to say Kick-Ass seems really comparable. But I have a feeling this movie probably costs more than Kick-Ass.
Yes, it did.
Because it's a studio film, right? So
yes. Yeah. And Kick-Ass was done entirely independently.
Right, right.
But the thing is Kick-Ass didn't have – first of all, we all know Kick-Ass didn't have a great marketing campaign, and they didn't have a far-out marketing campaign. Like, they did not actively put this in front of people months and months in advance. Their version of a marketing campaign was –
All right, we're recording again. We lost you for a second, Cargo, and now we have you on the phone. So, yeah. Okay, so the big question is, if you had to guess, is Scott Pilgrim versus the World going to do about as good as Kick-Ass, much better than Kick-Ass, or worse than Kick-Ass?
I think it's definitely going to do better than Kick-Ass.
Why is that?
The thing we have to keep in mind is Scott Pilgrim versus the World is rated PG-13 while Kick-Ass was rated R. That's one of the things a lot of people don't take into account. They keep comparing Kick-Ass to other superhero movies. And the truth is, Kick-Ass isn't like other superhero movies because other superhero movies are PG-13, not rated R.
That being said, they did essentially market or advertise Kick-Ass like it was a PG-13 movie.
Sure, which is exactly why the kids who wanted to see it couldn't get into it or bought tickets to other movies. And then, you know, that's the weekend where they bought tickets to How to Train Your Dragon and then kind of slipped in to go see Kick-Ass. Yep. So Kick-Ass got robbed, but at the same time, that's what happens when you make a rated R movie that appeals to teenagers.
Right, right. I mean, it just... the thing is, I remember I read Drew from HitFix's... like when I was doing quote unquote research into the whole Kick-Ass like box office and how well it did, I read Drew from HitFix's take on the Kick-Ass situation back when Lionsgate bought it, and he was saying how like this is Lionsgate's chance to like really, you know, prove that it can take this kind of scrappy indie comic book action film and like do a really nice job marketing this like R-rated property, and you know, get it to like $100 million. And I feel like they utterly failed at doing that. I don't know. I mean, I know that Kick-Ass is going to be profitable. You know, Matthew Vaughn's going to be fine. Mark Millar is going to be fine. But I just feel like it's a missed opportunity. And I wonder how that's going to play into the Scott Pilgrim versus the World marketing and the lead up to that movie.
Well, first of all, that has a much more... The thing you're going to see with Scott Pilgrim versus the World is, first of all, they can do something they can't do with Kick-Ass, which is appeal directly to girls. Now, Kick-Ass, girls really like Kick-Ass because it's got a really great, adorable, strong female character, but that doesn't play in the trailers.
And right.
There's nothing about the trailers that say, girls, you're going to dig this.
Right.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World does. And girls are starting to buzz about it. They're starting to talk about it. They love Michael Cera. They love the fact that it's a boyfriend-girlfriend story. They love the fact that it's him going up against all these other boyfriends. And it's a fantasy, and it appeals. And this is a great period in time for that, especially because Twilight is bringing girls in droves to see movies with their friends that appeal to them in a fantasy way. So,
all right, man. Yeah, you've convinced me. I think it definitely has a chance to do better. Whether it will or not is a different question. But I think
the only thing that's got me held up is that it's August. Fact that it's coming out in August, I think it can work. But August numbers are never huge.
Right.
They're always they're like April and early. They're like April numbers.
Right.
So I don't know exactly what we're looking at, but I think that because it's PG-13 and because it appeals to women, we have a really good chance that it could do really well. But then again, I don't know. And I really don't know how this marketing campaign is going to go, if it's going to backfire or not.
Yeah, so going back to that, like the conclusion is that we think it's kind of unorthodox, but not in the good way, right?
Yeah, I think nobody's really complaining about it too loudly yet, and I'm almost afraid that I'm one of the first people to start complaining about it. But by the same token, it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, it's not exactly above the board. Everyone's like, hey, if you really want this, tell us that you want it, and we'll give it to you. And it's like, no, you were going to give it to us anyway. It's a commercial.
Right.
You've got us clicking, I like this, so that you can show me a commercial later.
Right.
Now, if it were, hey, come here and click like now, and we'll show you the trailer, and this is the only place you can see it, then it's like, all right, I'm getting something out of doing this.
Yeah.
We were going to get this anyway. So
right.
I think it's trying to capitalize on the whole viral thing, and I don't think it's I'm not sold on it, and I'm not sold that it's a great idea. Interestingly enough, the first day they shot up. Like once people started tweeting about it, it was, you know, 50, 60, 70,000. And last I checked, they were still at like 85,000. Now that may have changed now.
Right. They'll make it.
It had really slowed down.
I have a feeling they'll make it eventually, but probably not as quickly as they would like. You know, it kind of, again, to bring up a not quite perfect analogy, but it also reminds me of like, video game makers charging for demos, or in some way limiting access to demos, because it's like, this is a thing that's supposed to promote your product. Like you should try to make it as widely available as possible. and like making, not even making people jump through hoops, because that would be like what you said about just clicking like. It's like making people jump through, like, you know, hoops, and then take like not even, that aren't even in their control. You know what I mean? Of exactly. Like how many people signing up. It just, yeah, it's kind of social media marketing potentially gone awry. But but you know, we'll see what happens with they'll probably get what they want. I mean, they're definitely going to release a trailer. They'll probably get what they want. But if this is a trend, I think we can say we both disapprove.
Yeah.
But you were talking about girls taking their friends to go to the theater,
and here's the segue.
You reviewed Sex and the City 2 recently.
Yes, I did.
So
me and everyone else in the world, apparently.
So what did you think of, first of all, like, walk me through the kind of, let us peer behind the curtain at Ain't It Cool News. Were you like, did you see that this movie's coming out and your hand shot up and you're like, I want this assignment? Or was Harry like, I need this movie reviewed, and you were like, you know, you owed someone a favor? You know, like, what?
Ain't It Cool News works differently than any other site on the planet, just straight up. We are not the well-oiled machine. We appear sometimes, and when you see weird, chaotic stuff happen on the site, it's a result of what it is. You know, having been around the longest and being the biggest, it's one of those things where the studios don't put the same restrictions on us that they put on other sites. So we're never told we can only have one person attend a movie. We all get invited.
Right.
And so everyone who writes for Ain't It Cool News can pretty much get into almost any movie they want to get into. And as a result, we can cover whatever we want.
Yeah. And okay. So, but that brings up the question even more. Like if you, you know, conversely, you don't have to cover Sex and the City 2 if you don't want to.
Right.
So why did you choose to do it?
Well, I cemented my spot as the guy who jumps on grenades a long time ago. I will see anything, and I will watch anything once. And if it's a cultural event, I'm going to watch it anyway. Like, whether I saw it in a theater or whether I saw it on DVD, I would have seen the Sex and the City movies just to know what I was talking about. And also because I'm a film lover. And I'm willing to give anything a chance. I did not walk into these movies with the notion that there's no way I'm going to like this movie. I can't wait to destroy it. It's, you know what? I hope I really like this.
Right.
The second time around, I was like, I don't expect to like this, but I hope I do.
So you're one of the few people that thinks Sex and the City 2 is better than Sex and the City 1.
I do. It's much better. Now, apparently, I am radically different from everyone else, but most other people who have reviewed it have character issues. Whereas they're like
the actual reviewers, or the issues of the movie you're talking about?
No, the issues of the movie. The main issue that people have with the movie is that the characters are not as true in this episode, so to speak,
right,
as they are in several of the other shows and in the other movie. That a lot of people were complaining that Sarah Jessica Parker was just whiny, and she was much whinier than she was in previously. Like, she was always the one to smack everyone around, and that Miranda was just being obnoxious and needed to be smacked, and that they didn't really give the other girls enough to do, and those girls really didn't seem like they had in the past, and it seemed like it was really lazy writing with the characters. And for me, I don't care about the characters. I mean, I care about characters in movies, but these, in neither of these films and in none of the episodes I've seen, have I ever gotten a sense of the character above stereotype level. And so for them to swap stereotypes back and forth didn't actually, you know, leave an impression on me. And my problem with the first film was that it was incredibly episodic. It was literally pieced together as if it were 5 or 6 episodes from the show. And we would deal with a subplot for 15, 20, 25 minutes, and then we'd move on to a completely different subplot, but there was no actual plot to the movie. And at the same time, it was loaded with scatological humor. And that was why I so brutally reviewed it the first time, was it was nothing more than an Adam Sandler film masquerading as female entertainment. I mean, a woman defecates herself. Another woman comes out in a swimsuit. She's got pubic hair dangling out of her clothing. There's a number of gags in that vein that were just really crass and base and disgusting. And I was like, this is exactly what I get on Kevin James about, and on Adam Sandler about, and on that whole group of guys, the whole Happy Madison group. This is a Happy Madison movie. What the hell? And so as a result, I really hated it for that and for the episodic nature of it. This actually has something of a story to it. It still doesn't have a plot. But at least this time around, it's like, okay, the girls get invited to go to Abu Dhabi for a week, and here are the various adventures they go on while they're in Abu Dhabi. And it has a flow to it, and it makes sense, and it doesn't feel as piecemeal. It's still crap, but it's just better crap than it was last time. I didn't walk out offended this time. And ultimately, at the end of this one, I was really satisfied with the ending, because I watched for nearly 2.5 hours. This movie is nearly 2.5 hours long. These girls march around Abu Dhabi being the ugly Americans, and by the end of the film, they're all but run out on a rail. I mean, they spend the last 20 minutes of the movie running around Abu Dhabi trying to collect up all their stuff so they can get the hell out of there, because they're pretty much being thrown out of the country. And I was very satisfied with that ending. I was like, you know what? I've been really angry at these girls for almost 2 hours now. I'm really happy to see them getting what they deserve.
I mean, other people were kind of troubled by the way that the movie celebrated consumerism and vapidness and, you know, self-egocentrism and all those things that make people hate America.
Yeah, but it's also, that's the problem with the show in general. I mean,
I don't know about that. I mean, let me just say that I have actually watched a substantial portion of the show, like, you know, of the however many episodes there were. And I actually found it, you know, the comparison that came to mind, and you can already tell, like, I have really bizarre comparisons, so you may not agree with this, but it felt to me like, honestly, like a female-centric version of Seinfeld. I mean, not as funny and not as universal, but, you know, it marches out these people. Like, in Seinfeld, you have, like, the close talker and, you know, all these names for people that the romantic partners of the different characters in Seinfeld. And here you have kind of the same thing here. But instead of, like, the close talker or, you know, the sponge-worthy guy, it's... Well, actually, yeah, you do have the sponge-worthy guy. But you have, you know, the guy who's, like... Who's like splooge tastes weird, you know, in Sex and the City. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like, it felt like that. Like it felt similar in the way it dealt with relationships. And so what I'm saying is that I actually thought the show was kind of clever in a lot of ways, and that the focus was not necessarily on the woman's the characters kind of the bad parts of the characters as much. Which it seems like the movie does focus.
It was also very much, every episode was something like 22 to 24 minutes, right?
Right.
And it's a half hour show. And you don't have enough time to kind of languish in that. But in the episodes that I've watched, and I haven't watched a lot, but I've watched, I guess, half a dozen, maybe close to a dozen episodes. And then I've, of course, seen the first movie. And this didn't strike me as much different, and it was very consumer driven, but that's how it's always kind of struck me in the past. But I can't. You've seen more of it than I have, but that's how it always struck me. So it didn't strike me any. It didn't strike me any different.
Fair enough. That's fair enough.
But what did get me was I was offended by the notion that. See, what you just hit on was like every episode was like, okay, this guy's splooge tasted weird, and okay, here's the episode where we talk about anal sex, and here's the episode where we talk about this and that. They've done everything offensive they could, and in the last movie, they got positively scatological. This time around, the only thing they could do left to do anything shocking was, hey, let's go to one of the most conservative places on the planet, and let's act shocking there.
Right.
I mean, had it not been set in Abu Dhabi, had they been invited to an Amish town, I think people would have found it much more offensive.
Why is that?
Oh, just because the entirety of that kind of concept was to kind of point out at the Middle East and go, look at how overly conservative they are. Look at how repressive they are. Look at what a terrible society this is. And aren't we much better that we're Americans? There's one section in which one of the characters gets arrested for having sex out on the beach with someone. And she's like in shock. She's like, this would have never happened. And da 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 da. And at the end of the movie, in the montage, it shows that character having sex on a beach in the good old US of A with fireworks going off during the 4th of July. And it's like, yes, it's great. We're back in the USA and we can have sex on a beach. And I was sitting there thinking, I can't think of a single state in the union where you wouldn't get arrested for having sex on the beach
right.
in the United States. I know here in Texas, you certainly can't have sex out on the beach.
Yeah, you found out firsthand, right, Cargill?
Yes, me and Peter learned that the hard way when he visited last time.
So, wait, why do you think it'd be more offensive if it was Amish country?
Because then we would have, the thing is the Amish are Christian. And they are about as good a Christian group of people there are in the world. They're just incredible Christians. The entirety of their belief system is built around a very literal adaptation of the Bible, where you aren't baptized at birth, you become baptized as an adult. And so when you're baptized, that's when you choose to become Amish. Like, you're raised Amish, but then you get the Rumspringa experience. And when you decide, I'm going to stay here and be a part of this society, you get baptized, and then you live according to the community and to, you know, these beliefs that are built entirely around what's best for the community, not what's best for us or what's best for, you know, each individual family. It's what's best for the community.
Right. I still don't understand why it would be more offensive here.
Because if the Sex and the City girls went in there and just started offending the Amish and their Christian beliefs, I think more people in the audience would go, hey, wait a second. That is kind of offensive. And, they're not doing things right. And that's, they're disrespecting these people's Christian beliefs. Muslims, most people in this country don't actually realize that that Islam comes out of Christianity.
So the movie kind of plays off of American ignorance to some degree, and maybe xenophobia, you're saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the entire movie is about these four ignorant characters wandering around, and one of them is even kind of comically trying to fit in and learn the language and learn the customs, and is trying to explain the customs to the other girls who just don't care.
Right.
And which is where my review kind of went off into the notion that I can't tell if King, the director, if he's actually making fun of these girls in the audience,
right?
Or if that's what he actually believes. And it's either he's one of the most ignorant directors known to man, or he's a director who wanted to insult his audience.
Right, I'm trying to think of another example of a film where, you know, the director is mocking the very fan base he was appealing to.
Yeah, and it really doesn't happen.
Maybe Joseph Kahn's Torque. If I could, that's one that comes immediately to mind.
So you and I have never talked about his appearance on the show.
Okay, yeah. So yeah,
was he actually making fun of the audience?
Well, he was making fun of the genre of movies of, first of all, you should listen to that episode. And second of all, according to him, he was making fun of that entire genre of movies. So,
which I 100% believe.
Right.
In fact, when I walked out of that film, and if you go back and read my review, I said, movies this bad don't happen by accident.
Right.
I wanted to believe that guy was deliberately making fun of something. Although at the same time, I wouldn't call it good satire because the satire doesn't show through.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And the thing is, you know that the people who are going to go see that movie are people that like the Fast and the Furious, probably. You know.
Yes.
And not think it's dumb.
Yeah.
Maybe they think it's dumb, but they at very least liked that it was, you know, liked it despite itself.
Yeah, like the Fast and the Furious, it was the serious one, because, like, the parking meters didn't melt when they drove fast, because you still know it don't melt at, like, 200 miles an hour. That's just silly.
Nice impression of the Fast and Furious. That is actually pretty representative of the average Fast and the Furious fan.
And I happen to be a Fast and the Furious fan, so I can
agreed,
make fun of
that. Agreed. Yeah, I mean, I am also a fan of that film. Let's go back to the Sex and the City 2, though. Today, Andrew Pulver... not today, but yesterday, Andrew Pulver wrote an article in The Guardian called Sex and the City 2, Rise of the Critic-Proof Movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the point that he was making, obviously, is that, you know, this movie and just like G.I. Joe, just like Transformers, Revenge of the Fallen, it's almost like the harder critics try to destroy this film, the more money it makes.
I don't know if that's true.
No, I know. I mean, this movie is not going to do as well as the first one, but still, you know,
I found it odd because I did see that title, and it was one of those titles that just struck me weird, as if these things haven't already existed. I mean, Transformers 2 is a perfect example of a critic-proof movie. I mean, that movie was universally panned by critics. And, I mean, guys like us, you know, the Ain't It Cool guys who are the most forgiving of Michael Bay and of Transformer films, we all hated the crap out of that movie. And, I mean, everyone just hated on this movie, and it made $400 million domestically.
Yep.
And people were like, shut up, I like it. And then on top of that, you have the movies that me and Corey always joke about being absolutely critic-proof, which are the Tyler Perry movies. Because a Tyler Perry movie is going to open at pretty much the same amount any given weekend that it opens up, because it has a built-in audience that is just going to come and see it regardless of what they thought of the last one or regardless of what anybody says about this one.
Right. So, I mean, so what is your reaction? Like, what is your...
Critic, I mean, the movie is critic-proof. I mean, it absolutely is. That's why I tried to, in my piece... Like, the last one, I was, you know, more than happy to have a slam dunk contest on it. But this time around, I knew everybody was going to do the slam dunk contest, so I zagged instead of zigged and tried to write something that actually went more in depth to what I felt was wrong with the film, which is why I wrote one of the least funny of the reviews out there. But the it's really one of those things that... women are seeing it one way or the other. I wrote a piece earlier this week called Sexism in the City, which was all about the way we critics get treated when this comes out. I had a woman who, I'm not going to call her out, but she's a producer on a film. She's an executive producer on a film that's in production. And she was emailing the hell out of me telling me, you guys need to hire a woman to cover women movies because women watch women movies and guys watch guy movies and you can't understand this film because you're a man. And I, you know, the first time I emailed her back, I said, hey, you know, all due respect, but if I had emailed you and said that, that you're a woman and you can't possibly understand this, and so you need to get a man to do this job, you would have come after me with a claw hammer and a team of lawyers. because, I mean, it's, you know, could you imagine if I had the audacity to tell a woman what she couldn't do? But I've had a number of women email me this week and tell me that I'm a man, there's no way I can understand it, there's no way I can do this job, so, you know, leave these movies to the women. But the other thing most of these women tell me is, look, we're not expecting a good movie. We don't want necessarily, I mean, we'd really like this to be good, but this is about the experience. This is about spending 2.5 more hours with old friends, and we're all of our girlfriends are getting together with us. We're going out for Cosmos. We're going to go see the movie. We're going to go out for Cosmos afterwards, and it's all about the experience. We don't care if it's good. Let us have it. And that's the whole thing with Sex and the City. It has that built-in audience of people who aren't even in it for quality. They're in it for the experience of it. They're in it to see these characters again, which is why so many of these women are starting to get angry, because the characters weren't the characters they were apparently accustomed